Rosie went to the window, propped the heels of her hands on the sill, and looked out. Across the street, laughing children ran the bases and pumped on the swings. Directly below her, a car was pulling in at the curb. There had been a time when the sight of a car pulling in like that would have terrified her, filled her with visions of Norman's fist and Norman's ring riding on it, riding toward her, the words service, loyalty, and community getting bigger and bigger until they seemed to fill the whole world. But that time had passed. Thank God. Actually, I think I did a little more than just get through it, she told the picture. I think I did a really good job. Robbie thought so, I know, but the one I really had to convince was Rhoda. I think she was prepared not to like me when I came in, because I was Robbie's find, you know? She turned toward the picture once more, turned as a woman will turn to a friend, wanting to judge from her face how some idea or statement strikes her. But of course the woman in the picture just went on looking down the hill toward the ruined temple, giving Rosie nothing but her back to judge from. You know how bitchy us gals can be, Rosie said and laughed. Except I really think I won her over. We only got through 50 pages, but I was a lot better toward the end. And besides, all those old paperbacks are short. I'll bet I can finish by Wednesday afternoon. And do you know the best thing? I'm making almost $120 a day. Not a week, a day. And there are 3 more Christina Bell novels. If Robbie and Rhoda give me those, I... She broke off, staring at the picture with wide eyes, not hearing the thin cries from the playground anymore, not even hearing the footsteps which were now climbing the stairs from the first floor. She was looking at the shape on the far right side of the picture again. Curve of brow, curve of bland, pupilless eye, curve of ear. A sudden insight came to her. She had been both right and wrong. Right about that second crash statue's not being visible before, wrong in her impression that the stone head had somehow just materialized in the picture while she'd been off recording the manta ray. Her idea that the folds in the woman's dress had changed position might have been her subconscious mind's effort to bolster that first erroneous impression by creating a kind of hallucination. It did, after all, make slightly more sense than what she was seeing now. The picture is bigger, Rosie said. No, that wasn't quite it. She lifted her hands, sizing the air in front of the hung picture and confirming the fact that it was still covering the same 3 feet by 2 feet area of wall. She was also seeing the same amount of white matting inside the frame, so what was the big deal? That second stone head wasn't there before, and that's the big deal, she thought. Maybe... Rosie suddenly felt dizzy and a little sick to her stomach. She closed her eyes tightly and began rubbing at her temples where a headache was trying to be born. When she opened her eyes and looked at the picture again, it burst upon her as it had the first time, not as separate elements. The temple, the fallen statues, the rose madder chiton, the raised left hand, but as an integrated whole, something which called to her in its own voice. There was more to look at now. She was nearly positive that this impression wasn't hallucination, but simple fact. The picture wasn't really bigger, but she could see more on both sides, and on the top and bottom as well. It was as if a movie projectionist had just realized he was using the wrong lens and switched, turning boxy 35mm into widescreen Cinerama 70. Now you could see not just Clint, but the cowboys on both sides of him as well. You're nuts, Rosie. Pictures don't get bigger. No? Then how do you explain the second god? She was sure it had been there all the time, and she was only seeing it now because there's more right in the picture now, she murmured. Her eyes were very wide, although it would have been difficult to say if the expression in them was dismay or wonder. Also more left, and more up, and more... There was a sudden flurry of knocks on the door behind her, so fast and light they almost seemed to collide with each other. Rosie whirled around, feeling as if she were moving in slow motion or underwater. She hadn't locked the door. The knocks came again. She remembered the car she'd seen pulling up at the curb below, a small car, the kind of car a man traveling alone would be apt to rent from Hertz or Avis. And all thoughts of her picture were overwhelmed by another thought, one edged about in dark tones of resignation and despair. Norman had found her, after all. It had taken him a while, but somehow he had done it. Part of her last conversation with Anna recurred, Anna asking what she'd do if Norman did show up. Lock the door and dial 911, she'd said, but she had forgotten to lock the door, and there was no phone. That last was the most hideous irony of all, because there was a jack in the corner of the living room area, and the jack was live. She'd gone to the phone company on her lunch hour today and paid a deposit. The woman who waited on her had given her her new telephone number on a little white card. Rosie had tucked it into her purse, and then out the door she'd marched, right past the display of phones for sale she had marched, thinking she could get one at least $10 cheaper by marching out to the Lakeview Mall when she got a chance. And now, just because she'd wanted to save a lousy $10. Silence from the other side of the door. But when she dropped her eyes to the crack at the bottom, she could see the shapes of his shoes. Big, black, shiny shoes they would be. He no longer wore the uniform, but he still wore those black shoes. They were hard shoes. She could testify to that, because she had worn their marks on her legs and belly and buttocks many times over her years with him. The knocking was repeated. Three quick series of three rap, 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 pause, rap, rap, rap. Pause. Rap, rap, rap. Once again, as during her terrible breathless panic that morning in the recording booth, Rosie's mind turned to the woman in the picture, standing there on top of the overgrown hill, not afraid of the coming thunderstorm, not afraid that the ruins slumped below her might be haunted by ghosts or trolls, or just some wandering band of thugs, not afraid of anything. You could tell by the set of her back, by the way her hand was so nonchalantly raised. Even so Rosie really believed, by the shape of that one barely glimpsed breast. I'm not her. I am afraid. So afraid I'm almost wetting my pants. But I'm not going to let you just take me, Norman. I swear to God I won't do that. For a moment or two, she tried to remember the throw Gert Kinshaw had shown her, the one where you seized the forearms of your onrushing opponent and then turned sideways. It was no good. When she tried to visualize the crucial move, all she could see was Norman coming at her, his lips drawn back to show his teeth, drawn back in what she thought of as his biting smile, wanting to talk to her, up close, right up close. Her grocery bag was still standing on the kitchen counter with a yellow picnic announcement flyers beside it. She'd taken out the perishables and stuck them in the refrigerator, but the few canned goods she'd picked up were still in the bag. She walked across to the counter on legs which seemed as devoid of feeling as wooden planks and reached in. Three more quick knocks. Rap, rap, rap. Coming, Rosie said. Her voice sounded amazingly calm to her own ears. She pulled out the biggest thing left in the bag, a 2-pound can of fruit cocktail. She closed her hand around it as best she could and started toward the door on her numb wood plank legs. I'm coming. Just a second, be right there.
While Rosie was marketing, Norman Daniels was lying on a white stone hotel bed in his underwear, smoking a cigarette and staring up at the ceiling. He had picked up the smoking habit as many boys do, hooking cigarettes from his dad's packs of Pall Malls, resigning himself to a beating if he got caught, thinking that possibility a fair trade for the status you gain by being seen downtown on the corner of State and Route 49, leaning against a phone pole outside the Aubreyville drugstore and post office, perfectly at home, with the collar of your jacket turned up and that cigarette dripping down from your lower lip. Crazy, baby, I'm just a real cool breeze. When your friends passed in their old cars, how could they know you'd hawked the butt from the pack on your old man's dresser, or that the one time you'd gotten up courage enough to try and buy a pack of your own in the drug, Old man Gregory had snorted and told you to come back when you could grow a mustache. Smoking had been a big deal at 15, a very big deal, something that had made up for all the stuff he hadn't been able to have. A car, for instance, even an old jalop like the ones his friends drove, cars with primer on the rocker panels and white plastic steel around the headlights and bumpers held on with twists of haywire. And by the time he was 16, he was hooked, 2 packs a day and a bona fide smoker's hack in the morning. 3 years after he married Rose, her entire family, father, mother, 16-year-old brother, had been killed on that same Route 49. They had been coming back from an afternoon of swimming at Philo's Quarry when a gravel truck veered across the road and wiped them out like flies on a window pane. Old man McClendon's severed head had been found in a ditch 30 yards from the crash, with the mouth open and a generous splash of crow shit in one eye. By then, Daniels was a cop, and cops heard such things. These facts hadn't disturbed Daniels in the least. He had, in fact, been delighted by the accident. As far as he was concerned, the nosy old bastard had gotten exactly what he had coming to him. McClendon had been prone to asking his daughter questions he had no business asking. Rose wasn't McClendon's daughter anymore, after all, not in the eyes of the law, at least. In the eyes of the law, she had become Norman Daniels' wife. He dragged deep on his cigarette, blew 3 smoke rings, and watched them float slowly toward the ceiling in a stack. Outside, traffic beeped and honked. He had only been here half a day, and already he hated this city. It was too big. It had too many hiding places. Not that it mattered, because things were right on track, and soon a very hard and very heavy brick wall was going to drop onto Craig McClendon's wayward little daughter, Rosie. At the McClendon funeral, a triple header with just about everyone in Aubreyville in attendance, Daniels had started coughing and had been unable to stop. People were turning around to look at him, and he hated that kind of staring worse than practically anything. Red-faced, furious with embarrassment, but still unable to stop coughing, Daniels pushed past his sobbing young wife and hurried out of the church with one hand pressed uselessly over his mouth. He stood outside, coughing so hard at first, he had to bend over and put his hands on his knees to keep from actually passing out, looking through his watery eyes at several others who had stepped out for cigarettes, 3 men and 2 women who weren't able to go cold turkey even for a lousy half-hour funeral service. And suddenly, he decided he was done smoking, just like that. He knew that the coughing fit might have been brought on by his usual summer allergies, but that didn't matter. It was a dumb fucking habit, maybe the dumbest fucking habit on the planet, and he was damned if some county coroner was going to write Paul Malls on the cause of death line of his death certificate. On the day he had come home and found Rosie gone, that night actually, after he discovered the ATM card was missing and could no longer put off facing what had to be faced, he had gone down to the store 24 at the bottom of the hill and bought his first pack of cigarettes in 11 years. He had gone back to his old brand like a murderer returning to the scene of his crime. In hoc signo vinces was what it said on each blood-red pack. In this sign shalt thou conquer, according to his old man, who had conquered Daniels' mother in a lot of kitchen brawls, but not much else, so far as Norman had ever seen. The initial drag had made him feel dizzy, and by the time he'd finished the first cigarette, smoking it all the way down to a roach, he'd been sure he was going to puke, faint, or have a heart attack, maybe all 3 at once. But now here he was, back up to 2 packs a day, and hacking out that same old way down in the bottom of your lungs cough when he rolled out of bed in the morning. It was like he'd never been away. That was all right, though. He was going through a stressful life experience, as the psychology pukes like to say, and when people went through stressful life experiences, they often went back to their old habits. Habits, especially bad ones like smoking and drinking, were crutches, people said. So what? If you had a limp, what was wrong with using a crutch? Once he'd taken care of Rosie, made sure that if there was going to be an informal divorce, it would be on his own terms, you might say, he would throw all his crutches away. This time, for good. Norman turned his head and looked out the window. Not dark yet, but getting there. Close enough to get going, anyway. He didn't want to be late for his appointment. He mashed out his cigarette in the overflowing ashtray on the night table beside the telephone, swung his feet off the bed, and began to dress. There was no hurry. That was the nicest thing. He'd had all those accumulated off days coming, and Captain Hardaway hadn't been the slightest bit chintzy about giving them to him when he asked. There were two reasons for that, Norman reckoned. First, the newspapers and TV stations had made him the flavor of the month. Second, Captain Hardaway didn't like him, had twice sicked the IA shoe flies on him because of excessive force allegations, and had undoubtedly been glad to get rid of him for a while. "Tonight, bitch," Norman murmured as he rode down in the elevator, alone except for his reflection in the tired old mirror at the back of the car. "Tonight, if I get lucky, and I feel lucky." There was a line of cabs drawn up at the curb, but Daniels bypassed them. Cab drivers kept records, and sometimes they remembered faces. No, he would ride the bus again, a city bus this time. He walked briskly toward the bus stop on the corner, wondering if he had been kidding himself about feeling lucky, and deciding he had not been. He was close. He knew it. He knew it because he had found his way back into her head. The bus, one that ran the Green Line route, came around the corner and rolled up to where Norman was standing. He got on, paid his 4 bits, sat in back. He didn't have to be Rose tonight, what a relief, and looked out the window as the streets rolled by. Bar signs, restaurant signs, deli, beer, pizza by the slice, sexy topless girls. "You don't belong here, Rose," he thought as the bus went past the window of a restaurant named Pop's Kitchen. "Strictly Kansas City beef," said the blood-red neon sign in the window. "You don't belong here, but that's all right, because I'm here now. I've come to take you home. Take you somewhere, anyway." The tangles of neon and the darkening velvet sky made him think of the good old days when life hadn't seemed so weird and somehow claustrophobic, like the walls of a room that keeps getting smaller, slowly closing in on you. When the neon came on, the fun started. That was how it had been, anyway, back then in the relatively uncomplicated years of his 20s. You found a place where the neon was bright and you slipped in. Those days were gone, but most cops, most good cops, remembered how to slip around after dark, how to slip around behind the neon, and how to ride the street grease. A cop who couldn't do those things didn't last very long. He had been watching the signs march past and judged that he should be approaching Carolina Street now. He got to his feet, walked to the front of the bus, and stood there holding the pole. When the bus pulled up at the corner and the doors flapped open, he walked down the steps and slipped into the darkness without saying a word. He'd bought a city street map in the hotel newsstand, $6.50, outrageous, but the cost of asking directions could be even higher. People had a way of remembering the people who asked them directions. Sometimes they remembered even 5 years later, amazing but true, so it was better not to ask, in case something happened, something bad. Probably nothing would, but TCB and CYA were always the best rules to live by. According to his map, Carolina Street connected with Beaudry Place, about 4 blocks west of the bus stop. A nice little walk on a warm evening. Beaudry Place was where the Traveler's Aid Jew boy lived. Daniels walked slowly, really just sauntering, with his hands in his pockets. His expression was bemused and slightly dopey, giving no clue that all his senses were on yellow alert. He cataloged each passing car, each passing pedestrian, looking especially for anyone who appeared to be looking especially at him, to be seeing him. There was no one, and that was good. When he reached Thumper's house, and that's what it was, a house, not an apartment, another break, he walked past it twice, observing the car in the driveway and the light in the lower front window, living room window. The drapes were open, but the shears were drawn. Through them, he could see a soft, colored blur that had to be the television. Thumper was up. Thumper was home. Thumper was watching a little tube and maybe munching a carrot or two before heading down to the bus station, where he would try to help more women too stupid to deserve help, or too bad. Thumper hadn't been wearing a wedding ring, and had the look of a closet queer to Norman anyway, but better safe than sorry. He drifted up the driveway and peeked into Thumper's 4 or 5-year-old Ford, looking for anything that would suggest the man didn't live alone. He saw nothing that set off any warning bells. Satisfied, he looked up and down the residential street again and saw no one. "You don't have a mask," he thought. "You don't even have a nylon stocking you can pull over your face, Normie, do you?" No, he didn't. "You forgot, didn't you?" Well, actually, no, he hadn't. He had an idea that When the sun came up tomorrow, there was going to be one less urban Jew boy in the world. Because sometimes bad stuff happened, even in nice residential neighborhoods like this. Sometimes people broke in, jigs and junkies for the most part, of course, and there went the old ball game. Tough but true, shit happens, as the t-shirts and bumper stickers said. And sometimes, hard as it was to believe, shit happened to the right people instead of the wrong ones. Pravda reading Jew boys who helped wives get away from husbands, for instance. You couldn't just put up with stuff like that. It was no way to run a society. If everyone acted like that, there wouldn't even be a society. It was pretty much rampant behavior, though, because most of the bleeding hearts got away with it. Most of the bleeding hearts hadn't made the mistake of helping his wife, however, and this man had. Norman knew that as well as he knew his own name. This man had helped her. He mounted the steps, took one more quick look around, and rang the doorbell. He waited, then rang again. Now his ears, already attuned to catch the slightest noise, picked up the sound of approaching feet, not clack, 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 but hish, hish, hish. Thumper in his stocking feet, how cozy. Coming, coming, Thumper called. The door opened. Thumper looked out at him, big eyes swimming behind his horn-rimmed glasses. Can I help you? He asked. His outer shirt was unbuttoned and untucked, hanging over a strap-style t-shirt, the same style of t-shirt Norman himself wore, and suddenly it was too much. Suddenly it was the last straw, the one that fractured the old dromedary's spinal column, and he was insane with rage that a man like this should wear an undershirt like his, a white man's undershirt. I think you can, Norman said, and something in his face or his voice, perhaps it was both, must have alarmed Slowick, because his brown eyes widened, and he started to draw back, his hand going to the door, probably meaning to slam it in Norman's face. If so, he was too late. Norman moved fast, seizing the sides of Slowick's outer shirt and driving him back into the house. Norman raised one foot and kicked the door shut behind him, feeling as graceful as Gene Kelly in an MGM musical. Yeah, I think so, he said again. I hope for your sake you can. I'm going to ask you some questions, Thumper. Good questions, and you better pray to your big-nosed Jew boy God that you're able to come up with some good answers. Get out of here, Slowick cried, or I'll call the police. Norman Daniels had a good chuckle at that, and then he whirled Slowick around, twisting Slowick's left fist up until it touched his scrawny right shoulder blade. Slowick began to scream. Norman reached between his legs and cupped his testicles. Stop, he said. Stop it right now, or I'll pop your balls like grapes. You'll hear them go. Thumper stopped. He was gasping and letting out an occasional choked whimper, but Norman could live with that. He herded Thumper back into the living room, where he used the remote control he found sitting on an end table to turn up the television. He frog-marched his new pal into the kitchen and let go of him. Stand against the refrigerator, he said. I want to see your ass and shoulder blades squashed right up against that baby, and if you move so much as an inch away from it, I'll rip your lips off. Got it? Yes, Thumper said. Who are you? He still looked like Bambi's friend Thumper, but now he was starting to sound like Woodsy fucking Owl. Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Norman said. This is how I spend my day off. He began pulling open the drawers along the counter, keeping an eye on Thumper as he did so. He didn't think old Thump was going to run, but he might. Once people got beyond a certain level of fright, they became as unpredictable as tornadoes. What? I don't know what. You don't have to know what, Norman said. That's the beauty of this, Thump. You don't have to know a goddamn thing except the answers to a few very simple questions. Everything else can be left to me. I'm a professional. Think of me as one of the good hands people. He found what he was looking for in the fifth and last drawer down the line, two oven gloves with flower patterns. How cute! Just what the well-dressed Jew boy would want to wear when taking his widow kosher casseroles out of his widow kosher oven. Norman pulled them on, then went quickly back down the drawer pulls, rubbing out any prints he might have left. Then he marched Thumper back into the living room, where he picked up the remote control and wiped it briskly on the front of his shirt. We're going to have us a little face-to-face here, Thumper, Norman said as he did this. His throat had thickened. The voice which came out of it sounded barely human, even to its owner. Norman wasn't very surprised to find he had a raging hard-on. He tossed the remote control onto the sofa and turned to Slowick, who was standing there with his shoulders slumped and tears oozing out from beneath his thick, horn-rimmed glasses, standing there in that white man's undershirt. "I'm going to talk to you up close. Right up close. Do you believe that? You better, Thump. You just fucking better." "Please," Slowick moaned. He held his shaking hands out to Norman. "Please, don't hurt me. You've got the wrong man. Whoever you want, it's not me. I can't help you." But in the end, Slowick helped quite a bit. By then, they were down cellar because Norman had begun to bite, and not even the TV turned all the way to top volume would have completely stifled the man's screams. But screams or no screams, he helped quite a bit. When the festivities were over, Norman found the garbage bags under the kitchen sink. Into one of these he put the oven gloves and his own shirt, which could not now be worn in public. He would take the bag with him and get rid of it later. Upstairs, in Thumper's bedroom, he found only one item of clothing that would come even close to covering his own much broader upper body, a baggy, faded Chicago Bulls sweatshirt. Norman laid this on the bed, then went into Thumper's bathroom and turned on Thumper's shower. While he waited for the water to run hot, he looked in Thumper's medicine cabinet, found a bottle of Advil, and took four. His teeth hurt and his jaws ached. The entire lower half of his face was covered with blood and hair and little tags of skin. He stepped into the shower and grabbed Thump's bar of Irish Spring, reminding himself to dump that into the bag, too. He actually didn't know how much good any of these precautions were going to be because he had no idea how much forensic evidence he might have left downstairs in the basement. He had kind of grayed out there for a while. As he washed his hair, he began to sing, "Ramblin' Rose, Ramblin' Rose, where you ramble, no one knows, wild and wind-blown, that's how you've grown. Who can cling to a ramblin' rose?" He turned off the shower, stepped out, and looked at his own faint, ghostly image in the steamy mirror over the sink. "I can," he said flatly. "I can. That's who."
Bill Steiner was raising his free hand to knock yet again, mentally cursing his nervousness. He was a man who wasn't ordinarily nervous about women. When she answered, "Coming! I'm coming, just a second. Be right there." She didn't sound pissed, thank God, so maybe he hadn't rousted her out of the bathroom. "What in hell am I doing here anyway?" he asked himself again as the footsteps approached the door. "This is like a scene in some half-baked romantic comedy, kind of thing not even Tom Hanks can do much with." That might be true, but it didn't change the fact that the woman who had come into the shop last week had lodged firmly in his mind. And rather than fading as the days went by, her effect on him seemed to be cumulative. Two things were certain. This was the first time in his life he'd ever brought flowers to a woman he didn't know, and he hadn't felt this nervous about asking for a date since he'd been 16 years old. As the footsteps reached the other side of the door, Bill saw that one of the big daisies was on the verge of doing a header out of the bouquet. He made a hurried adjustment as the door opened, and when he looked up, he saw the woman who'd traded her fake diamond ring for a piece of bad art, standing there with murder in her eyes and a can of what looked like fruit cocktail raised over her head. She appeared frozen between her desire to make a preemptive strike and her mind's struggling realization that this wasn't the person she'd expected. It was, Bill thought later, one of the most exotic moments of his life. The two of them stood looking at each other across the door jamb of Rosie's second-floor room on Tremont Street. He with his bouquet of spring flowers from the shop two doors down on Hitchens Avenue, she with her 2-pound can of fruit cocktail raised over her head, and although the pause could not have lasted more than 2 or 3 seconds, It seemed very long to him. It was certainly long enough for him to realize something that was distressing, dismaying, annoying, amazing, and rather wonderful. Seeing her did not change things as he had rather expected it would. It made them worse instead. She wasn't beautiful, not the media version of beauty anyhow, but she was beautiful to him. The look of her lips and the line of her jaw, for some reason, just about stopped his heart. And the cat-like tilt of her bluish-gray eyes made him feel weak. His blood felt too high and his cheeks too hot. He knew perfectly well what these feelings signaled, and he resented them even as they made him captive. He held out the flowers to her, smiling hopefully but keeping tabs on the upraised can. "Truce?" he said.